How do you define a mathematician? Is it somebody who works at a math department?
That, I guess, is a question that doesn't really have an answer. So I define a mathematician depending on whatever I'm interested in.
Great. Welcome to our next episode of About Logic. And today we have a dear colleague of mine, at least at the moment when we're recording, because then I'm still affiliated with Brussels, Colin Jakob Rittberg, who's a postdoc at the Freie Universität in Brussels. And he's doing something called Philosophy of Mathematical Practice.
That's true.
That's maybe already our first question. And we're talking here about logic and foundations, but also about philosophy of math. So would you give our listeners like a very short rundown? What's philosophy of mathematical practice?
Well, I guess philosophy of mathematical practice broadly wants to understand what mathematicians are doing. So individual activity of mathematicians, the institutions that they play a role in mathematical research and mathematical knowledge making. It's about communal activities. So understanding kind of mathematics as it is being done.
So how do you define a mathematician? Is it somebody who works at a math department?
That, I guess, is a question that doesn't really have an answer. So I define a mathematician depending on whatever I'm interested in. In my usual research, I'm interested in research mathematics. So I'm thinking about mathematicians who tend to work at universities and kind of publish in mathematical journals, even though they might not be hired as mathematicians, right? They might be computer scientists, or they might be theoretical physicists or something like this. But of course, I mean, if you think about mathematics education, a mathematician might very well be the 14-year-old sitting in the classroom. And you're talking about
sure.
mathematician from that perspective. So I wouldn't want to give a clear-cut definition of what a mathematician is. In the philosophy of mathematical practice, research effort focuses on research mathematics. But your definition
but
of
not just
is lacking, yeah.
And not just done at the math department. And not only done at the math department.
Because, necessarily. No, not necessarily.
Yeah. So my impression, I mean, I haven't really, maybe you can tell me more about your research, but my impression is that you're very much about the culture of mathematics, or is this wrong to say?
No, there's a kind of subfield in the philosophy of mathematical practices called the mathematical cultures movement or field or whatever you want to call it. So where the real idea is to focus on cultures. Of course, that raises questions about what exactly is a culture and further issues. I'm very happy with that. So the mathematical cultures movement might be the one that I relate the most to in these various different strands, all collected under the big heading of philosophy of mathematical practices.
Yeah, because I always have this problem. Am I a mathematician? Some people say yes, but I sometimes say no, because I'm not really in this mainstream culture of mathematics. Yeah. And I'm quite, sometimes I can be quite cynical about it. Not that I think that computer science is all wonderful and better, but it's different. And I want to see whether you have got some observation about, I tell you one example, maybe you can interpret something for me. Yeah.
With you.
So, I mean, I'm intuitionist. So I've like used different foundations. I use type theory, if it means anything to you. But so I'm talking, we had actually already Kevin Buzzard in About Logic. And not at this conversation, but previously I talked to him and I said, so Kevin is interested in formalized mathematics. So he uses this Lean system. Yeah. And for me, the Lean system on the one hand is good because they use type theory. On the other hand, it's a bit disappointing because they're very classical, yeah. So I'm talking to Kevin and say like, so why are you try to convince him that sort of type theoretic principles are maybe interesting to consider, yeah. I'm not want to turn him into an intuitionist, but open up intuitionism. And then he says, yeah, this is all very interesting, but the field medalists, they wouldn't buy this. I mean, okay. I find this actually, this is quite strange because I want to have a discussion about philosophy. Yeah. I want to talk about foundations and he talks about sociology. Yeah. So can you interpret this for me?
I'm much more for the sociology than this type of philosophy then. Right.
Yeah.
So I guess, I mean, so if we're thinking about Kevin's work, right? So this whole idea of kind of digitalizing mathematics, so having some kind of computer verification of mathematical proofs, right? I guess, for this particular issue, then we want to capture the logics that are employed in ordinary mathematical proofs and then kind of run them through the machine to check for correctness, right? So
that's not, I don't think. Okay, so I think that's not even accurate, because the proofs, the nature of proofs, the nature of construction changes, even if you're classical, let's ignore this question. The nature of mathematical construction changes in the moment you use a formal system. So it's not about just formalizing existing mathematics. It's about transforming ideas from existing mathematics, but it makes it different and also creates different ideas, different dynamic. Yeah. So
absolutely. I fully agree with you. Right. This is Lakatos 101. Huh? So the translation of the proof as written into whatever formal system you might use to then assess it, and I guess that's an issue for kind of digitalizing mathematics in this way, right? And I'm with you on that. Nonetheless, there is a research effort that doesn't fully ignore that problem, but you know the philosophical ramifications of this are maybe considered to be minor or something. You know.
So which problem?
So the problem that you have an ordinary mathematical proof written in the ordinary style as published in academic journals, and the kind of computer verification code that you might need to verify them. Because what you're verifying, as you correctly point out, it's not the same. You're verifying the translation of the proof, right?
Actually, not even this. I don't agree.
Okay,
sorry.
Go ahead. Interesting.
I would say it's rather an opportunity to reinvent the proof and have quite a different proof and have a different perception of the subject. So it's not. I think when you say digitalization of mathematics, that doesn't do it. It's not the right description, right? It's a new kind of mathematics, which is inspired and related to existing mathematics, but it also offers really new opportunities, new proofs, new ideas. Yeah. So it's really a cultural change. It's not just digitalizing existing mathematics. Yeah.
I guess there is a kind of, this is a philosophical question, what you're doing there, right? And I mean, so when I'm thinking about Scholze and the liquid tensor.
Yes.
What was it called? The liquid tensor. Right. So there the idea was to have an ordinary proof and worry about the correctness of that proof. And then go through the motions of digitalizing it and running it through, putting it into computer code, having libraries that can support this, and then check formally, kind of computer aided, computer assisted proof checking. Now, what you're checking is a translation of the thing, right? Nonetheless,
it's a new thing. And first of all, the original proof was actually wrong, right? So they created a new thing, which was not the translation of an existing thing, which is inspired by an existing argument on the whiteboard, maybe. And that's one thing. That's what this liquid tenders was about. But actually, it goes further. I mean, and I don't know if a good quote, but maybe it was Tao or something, where they really discover new mathematics by using a formal system. Mm-hmm. So I'm a bit sensitive to saying translation, digitalization is really a cultural change. It's a new kind of mathematics which is created, which is related and inspired to existing mathematics,
but it's not a mere translation. the framing in translations, because you think the objects are not closely related enough that you might call one.
I mean, they're related. They're related in the way that sort of one inspires the other. I mean, and they're certainly related. Yeah, uh-huh. But actually, it goes further. There are now things being created which are not related, which are really new, right? Which are because the way to do mathematics changes by getting a computer into the game, right?
Sure, sure. I mean, in many ways, and not just the kind of verification efforts, but I mean. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole
creation
of the creation, right? Collaborative efforts have, and you know, collaborative practices exactly. have changed massively. The digital transformations of mathematics are extremely impactful and impact mm-hmm. all sorts of aspects of mathematics. Yeah, absolutely.
Just maybe as a compromise, I think in some sense you agree, because there is this informal math or journal math, let's call it. And then there is some procedure and we get the formalized math. And this procedure might be called a translation. And then you can ask whether it's an adequate one, whether something got lost, whether something got added. And I think the reply to that is a philosophically very laden issue. Right? There are people, I mean, nowadays, Yasin Hamami, and I'm not sure who, it's often sometimes called the standard view even. Maybe that's not adequate, but they would say, no, this is in some sense the very same. It's just filling in gaps. It's whatever. And they are different conceptions. I think a lot of people would perceive that as the standard theory.
And yes, others would argue. Lots of people, but Dennis, what lots of people see never really
math is impressed a democratic
me, yeah?
issue.
Yeah. No. Better not. I mean, I always saw one thing which I always thought about philosophy of mathematics. So I went to some meetings even years ago, and I noticed that philosopher of mathematics. They think that by observing mathematicians, they can find out something about mathematics. And I thought, this is just the wrong people. Don't ask mathematicians about mathematics, because they have this really strong cultural bias. Yeah, they have a certain very limited perception of mathematics is about. And asking them, what is mathematics, is in my mind the wrong way to go.
That the question in that talk that you were listening to? Because you can certainly find out certain things about mathematics by talking to mathematicians, right?
Yes.
Sneaking claims can be counteracted by simply asking a mathematician who doesn't agree with the claim. Right? So if the claim would be all mathematicians are Platonists and you find a single one that, you know, proclaims not to be one. I mean, you know, so you can find out something, but I mean, of course, it's well known in any kind of empirical methodology that you can't just go to a practitioner and ask them about their practice, because the practitioners have warped views. Yeah, that's the case. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's particular. I'm particular. I mean, yes. So I think there was something about constructive mathematics, and basically they say it's the same as what the mathematicians are saying. It's like, that doesn't matter. We have already, that's an old story. Hilbert won the Grundlagenstreit. Who cares? That's from the past, right? And the philosophers sort of just, I mean, not all of them, but some of them sort of just repeated this perception, right? That's what I mean. Right?
Not sure I follow.
Okay, so what I'm saying is, I find that being an intuitionist, I'm quite critical about current mathematical practice, even though I understand that you should be open-minded and so on. I try my best. Dennis knows this, but I find it quite shocking, the sort of ignorance of mathematicians. With respect to constructive methods, right? I find this quite shocking. And then I've sometimes met philosophers who don't question this. I mean, you don't. Get me right. I mean, what I'm asking for is some awareness of that there is still an issue, that there's some people still, that people doing intuitionistic, actually more and more people doing intuitionistic mathematics, and mathematicians tend to completely ignore this. I mean, or many of them, they just don't really want to know, or they have sort of some misconceptions which they're often not interested to overcome. And I think you wrote something about this kind of things, the sort of open-mindedness, methodological alternatives. I don't know which words you used, but I thought you were exactly looking at this kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. I wrote a paper about humility in mathematics. So that was a research to kind of bring virtue epistemology, which uses kind of virtue theory to address epistemological issues, to the philosophy of mathematics. And that was a collaborative effort with Fenner Tanswell and Andrew Everdeen. And we've been kind of pushing the idea that, you know, virtue theory might be of help to engage with issues in the philosophy of maths that otherwise have been left unaddressed or addressed from different angles.
Don't you all think, I mean, when you say this, that foundations should be topic of discussion instead of just being assumed, but brought out in the open, and shouldn't mathematicians be aware of what foundations they're using and what alternatives they are? I mean, I don't know. They're not, I would say. Most of them are not.
And so I guess one argument, and you I'm curious to hear a counter argument to this, but one argument might be, well, it's mathematicians are already very busy people, just like all academics are. So to just get a grasp on your field of research, that's already heavy work, and to stay up to date. So why worry about other approaches to the very foundations of mathematics? Right? What are you?
Okay. First of all, I'm not expecting that they should learn about my area of research.
That's not what I meant.
No. But they use certain logical principles, and mathematicians often say logic isn't something they don't consider. It's not relevant, right? Because they just do mathematics and they don't have to reflect on what methods they're using. And I think a practitioner should always be in some sense reflective. I mean, you do something in mathematics and you should reflect on what you're doing. And part of this reflection, I think, is what foundational principles you're using, whether you set FC, whether you need choice, whether this can be framed constructively, and there are other things which are interesting. I mean, whether you're very dependent on representations, where representation independent, what? So these are questions which I think any practitioner should reflect upon, no matter how busy you are. Actually, this is important for the development of the subject, but also for the communicability of the subject. And my critique on contemporary mathematics is that this is very, very little. I mean, they would rather say, okay, logic, we don't care. We don't really want to do anything to do with this because we know how to do mathematics. Don't tell us.
I mean, I studied mathematics, and when I think back on this, I mean, we never had a course on the foundations of maths. I mean, I got a course on the foundations of math because I chose mathematical logic, which turned into set theory. So I saw some set theory, but it was also only just set theory, right? There was no category theory discussed. There was no intuitionistic logic. But most of my classmates, right? I mean, they didn't see any foundations, right? So foundations were not a thing. It was just mathematics is presented as this is it, and the very foundations of this. And also the philosophical foundations that come with this, right? I mean, the whole foundation debate is also a philosophical debate. None of this was discussed. And I agree that impoverishes the mathematical research culture, so mathematical cultures in general.
Maybe just short remarks on that. Because we already talked about cultures, there is a weird element concerning foundations that there is a nod towards them. Like in your linear algebra course, there is a moment where you say, oh, we are now talking about basis or vector spaces, and their choice is important, and we don't even spell out ZFC, but talk about choice in particular, and then say, oh, there's choiceless models. And of course, there are some equivocations there about constructive, non-constructive. We don't need to talk about right now. So there's this cultural knot at one hand. And then there is, on the other hand, there is maybe a division of labor at play nowadays. So the more extreme example is physics. They don't care about rigorous math in the journal math sense, right? They don't care whether this is the smooth thing or not. They just assume that for now and work out their theorems. Then there's the rigorous math mathematician going over that and finding the right formal apparatus. And there's this famous example of the Dirac delta function, where physicists just said, don't put this into an unbounded integral and nothing happens. But if you do, you get contradictions, but just don't do it. And then we got the proper reconstruction that this isn't really a function. And then we have the logicians who really care about whether this happened in ZFC or how many Grothendieck universes needed to be added, or whether maybe even Peano arithmetic suffices. There's, and we also talked about this with Kevin very shortly, that it's kind of open whether Fermat's last theorem needs how much they need. And his formalization effort will make that clearer, at least, give an upper bound. Yeah. So at least in current practice, maybe this is how mathematicians decided to solve it.
I mean, okay, I had the hopes that this, the formalization of mathematics in a way has already affected mathematical culture in this respect. Yeah, so very Coppola is this lean system, right? And lean is based on type theory. So actually lots of statements in lean, they are not actually very set theoretic. They are really type theoretic. Now, lean is a funny thing. It's a funny mixture of type theory and classical mathematics. So there are lots of, I mean, axiom of choice is assumed and so on. But still, there is already this different sort of perspective on how you present things, which is actually, in a way, this type theoretic way is much closer to this informal mathematical practice than set theory. Set theory is a bit of an artificial foundation, really.
Discussion. Others would say this iterative conception of set mimics it very well. That maybe let me phrase it slightly different. We just have an observation about mathematical practice that's clear for all three of us, but maybe wasn't clear to all of the listeners. And that's disagreement, a disagreement on the foundations in this case now. And this is, I mean, one of the dominating themes in your research, Colin, isn't it?
I want your answer.
You are the host. You can.
No, I was just protesting at how you phrased it. Yeah. I don't think there is a conflict about so much a conflict of foundations. There is a complete ignorance of foundations. That was my point. But sorry, Colin.
No. Okay. Yeah, but my disagreement would be some people say we care, some people say we don't care. Maybe it's a weaker kind of disagreement. But now back to Colin.
Right. Even though, I guess I would agree with Thorsten that people don't even say I don't care. They just don't even engage with the issue, right? And I think that's the ignorance that you talk about, right? I mean, it's just a kind of it's not part of the epistemic life. To come back to your disagreement point, I mean, disagreement was something that got me into philosophy, right? So I already mentioned that I studied mathematics, and I mean the anecdote goes as follows: at some point, Hugh Wooden comes along to give a talk at Swansea University, and he mentions at some point, you know, that something implies that V does not equal L, which is a set theoretic statement. He takes this now as, it being true. But this statement is, I mean, it's not provable from our theory. So to my mind, because, I mean, I was philosophically very naive at the time, you know, mathematics is just a game according to the rules. And, you know, the statement is neither provable nor disprovable. So it's neither true nor false. It's just, it's not decided by the game, and that's the end of the story. So how can somebody like Budin now come along and say, oh, you know, we know that this is wrong. And right, this statement is wrong, because it's neither right nor wrong. It's not decided. So I went home thinking, okay, this guy doesn't really know. And in my kind of juvenile hubris, because of course Hewitt is one of the leading mathematicians in the field. So of course he knows much better than me, the little student. And it got me interested and questioning kind of, okay, how can mathematicians have different views about the very mathematics that they study from me? Because mathematics should be kind of this value free, and you know, there shouldn't be any philosophical basis to any of this. And then in my master's thesis, I actually worked on Hampkins, who disagrees with Woody. So there's a kind of fundamental disagreement between the two. And I did this from a mathematical perspective, working out some details of Hampkins stuff, Hampkins and Loew actually. But now I got interested in this debate that they are having, where they disagree about. I mean, they're all of them are set theorists. They all agree that, you know, we should do set theory, the classical kind of set theory that is what we should be doing. It's not intuitionist logic. It's not type theory. It's not any of that stuff. No, it's just plain old set theory. Even in that small group of experts, there's disagreement about the very foundations of things, because so Hugh Woodin is what's called a monist. So he believes there is this one true state of affairs.
Oh yeah,
and this one
strong
true state
Platonist.
This particular statement, this V equal L statement that I just mentioned, you know, that is just wrong. Whereas for Hampkins, there's a multiverse, so he's a pluralist. There's a multiverse, there are multiple different universes, and in some of them the statement is true, and in some of them it's false, and that's the end of the story. So here we have two well-respected mathematicians in the field, but they disagree about some kind of more or less fundamental issues. And that got me excited about disagreements and the kind of philosophical underpinnings of mathematics.
Yeah. Can I comment on this? So I find it interesting because what this really questions is this idea that mathematics is about truth, right? Basically this Platonist view. And I find quite interesting that they sort of, they question this a little bit. I mean, okay, there's monism versus multiverse, but not fundamentally, right? Fundamentally, somehow these things are real. And I find, maybe going one step further, I mean, intuitionism means, I mean, these are all construction of our head, hence, we cannot really talking about their truth is very very artificial. It's a metaphor, not more, right? And this is in Grund, this is a basic criticism from intuitionism. I mean that mathematics is really a mental construction. It's not discovered, it's created, and because it's created, it has got a completely different nature from this, or we discover, and this V equals L we must discover the true nature of sets. And there isn't anything as a true nature of sets, because we created the sets. But, and then whatever, right. we are just referring to our intuitions, to our intuitive understanding, which we can communicate and which can be different, and which then reflected in formal statements, right? So I find it surprising at this point that you didn't buy into intuitionism, to be honest.
I have a very good explanation for this. I mean, ultimately, I do not care. So ultimately, I'm not really interested in the metaphysical underpinnings of mathematics. This is not what I care about. I care about what mathematicians are doing. That's basically my big bafflement, like what is happening. I find this fascinating, and I like to understand it. And I cared about this metaphysical questions. Only insofar as mathematicians are holding it. So, right, and then I worked out in my PhD, I worked out kind of how these metaphysical underpinnings of Hampkins and of Woodin influence their type of mathematics. So, right, they both state flat out, you know, I'm a Platonist, so they don't discuss it at any length. They just say, well, I'm a Platonist, now let's get on with business, and then they do business. And I'm interested not as in the question, you know, are they right or wrong about this? I was interested in kind of, okay, so if there is metaphysical underpinnings in mathematics, what are the influences of that, right? And of course, influences the type of research that you do, what kind of questions you find relevant, right? They agree about corrective proofs, but they disagree about significance, relevance.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They even publish together, right? So it's
you. Hamkins and Wooden.
I think you mentioned it once to me. Maybe the archive will know the answer.
Wooden was the PhD supervisor of Hamkins, and they also have papers together. Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
we should get those at the podcast as well. I think it's more likely that we get one of them than the other. But let's see what future tells us.
You'll see.
Now we add this kind of disagreements, but there are many more types of disagreement, right? Is there any other paper you want to plug in now on other conceptions?
I mean, other papers. So, I mean, I moved from the kind of metaphysical disagreements about maths to broader questions about what is relevant. And what became clear in that is that the kind of social structure of mathematics heavily impacts this. So I wrote a paper about epistemic injustice in mathematics, where the central case study is to work together with Fenner Tanswell yet again, and Jean-Paul von Mendenhagen. And the central case study is one about a young mathematician at the time, PhD or postdoc level. So there was a proof constructed and submitted to the journal and then rejected on the basis that this is already known and this is kind of obvious and it's not new enough to be published. And then the student complained about this and said, well, okay, if you say so, then show me where. Right. Show me where thing is. Give me any kind of lecture notes. Mention some conferences where this was discussed. And the reviewers failed to do so. And because it's a tiny field that this all happened in, the author of the proof was able to actually ask the experts in the field. And you know what they said was, well, we have the field. Well, we kind of know. Yes, it's true. We know. But I cannot point you to any kind of publication in this. So that you have this, that links with the notion of what's called a folk theorem. So these theorems in mathematics that are somehow known by the community, but whoever has proven them first, that's kind of lost in time. What exactly a folk theorem is, that's a deep question. Well, probably it doesn't have an answer because mathematicians use it more or less willy-nilly. But in the paper, we just use ghost theorem instead to make clear, okay, what we're talking about are theorems that the experts in the field claim at least to know, but it's not accessible to anybody outside of this kind of very small circle of experts. And then
it's a shame. The word folk theorem is quite nice, no?
The word folk theorem is
like
quite
a folk
nice.
Song.
Yeah, I mean, we settled for ghost theorems because the one literature that we found that actually discusses what a folk theorem is was discussing folk theorems in slightly different terms than what we wanted. So we mentioned that literature and then moved to a different term. In academic presentations that I give of this, I sometimes just talk about folk theorems. That's true. Yeah,
it's good. Yeah, just redefine the word. So I mean.
Why not, right? What this shows is that what counts as novel enough to be published depends on, in some extent on kind of background knowledges of expert communities that might not be accessible to others, right?
Yes.
And we discussed this in terms of epistemic injustice, so kind of with ethical terminology here. So epistemic injustices are injustices that occur on some epistemological dimension, so have to do with knowledge making. The classical case is testimonial injustice, where a judge doesn't listen to the testimony of somebody because of their color of skin or something silly like this. We then applied that kind of philosophical framework to discuss the case that I've just given. And that has sparked... Well, that has moved my research effort from thinking about disagreements in mathematics to thinking about the entanglement of ethical concerns and mathematical knowledge making. So I've written a paper on the kind of the epistemological relevance of social justice and power relations in mathematics. Right? So who gets to decide what's get to be published? What counts as serious enough? Right. So one case study that we discuss in there is again a PhD student who found a flaw in a fundamental paper of the field, and was able to correct that flaw. But was then dissuaded from publishing this because the academic standing wasn't high enough. Right? So this very much challenged this idea that in mathematics, you know, as long as your proof is correct, you will get some credit or something. And that is just not the case, right? So it's been chipping away at that kind of talk. Right?
Yeah. By the way, I mean, obviously, what you say, I mean, rings a bell. Obviously, I mean, we always have trouble with reviewer two, right? and they're different. And it's actually, maybe it's I don't know whether anybody systematically investigated this exactly what you described in these examples. I mean, I had recently trouble getting a paper published. Now it's accepted, but there were more than one repetition, and I thought it was a very important paper. And then it was reviewed by I think I know who it was, by a colleague who was culturally in a different position. Right? I mean, mm-hmm. It was a different culture. And he mm-hmm. says, oh, this word which you're using is not the right word, and what you're mm-hmm. doing is sort of not right, doesn't taste right, and is not, this is not such kind of theorem as you say, yeah? And then so on. So basically, I mean, he's a very good guy. He was not completely negative, but he still rejected the paper based on this. And this is like this sort of cultural bias, right? If you get a reviewer who has got like slightly different cultural background, then they may not like what you're doing, or they may suggest that you should really do it the way they would have done it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that this can also happen in mathematics, that is not obvious to non-mathematicians, to people who do not publish in mathematical journals. And many of my philosopher colleagues are very much part of that particular crowd. So they also do not think about mathematical research being published in this sort of way, right? In the kind of what non-ideal epistemology might call the non-idealities of mathematical publishing, right? So kind of the realities of people having different conceptions of how you should name your theorem and whether this theorem falls in one box or the other, about what counts as novel, I just mentioned, and all these kind of other aspects that are not just questions about right or wrong in a mathematical proof, but that are these, you mentioned culture, so let me use the word cultural dimensions of mathematical activity, right? And the here evaluation of proofs. Yeah.
So just very shortly, this remark, since Thorsten asked about studies, I'm not aware about people really speaking with reviewers, but there is the study by Christian Greifenhagen about editorial practices, so speaking with the editors, about these things like quick opinions, is this even interesting or not? And now, shameless self-publication, promotion, Colin and I edited a special issue on disagreement in Axiomata's Global Philosophy, and there Benedikt Loewe published a paper modeling disagreement between reviewers, but that's not an empirical study, so it's just if you are aware of that there are these other dimensions like interestingness, even if you assume correctnesses and stuff like that, one should mention that reviewers often don't even look at correctnesses in very detail. Some just say, oh, this looks kind of right. Or if this is right, then it would be interesting. And he modeled that. And so it's an interesting paper and should be open access. We will link it below. And the very final remark, and then we can change the topic if you want. It's an interesting fact that in math, you know who you are reviewing. So it's single-blinded usually. The author is known to the reviewers. So it's impossible in some sense to really blind people because there are only so few experts. So even you mm-hmm. have a gist who might be the reviewer from like this little mm-hmm. text. So mm-hmm. the other way around, it's clear. And if you really want to, nowadays, mathematicians in many fields upload their papers in the archive anyway. So just search for some sentences that you can reconstruct
actually,
the opposite.
Sorry, can I? Because I was just thinking also about this. I was going to pose the question. So I'm not a big fan of double-blind reviewing. I think it's in computer science is very common, and as you said, first of all, it's not really very effective, and also it's a bit artificial because often you want to understand somebody's work out of in the context of their previous work, and to set this attempt to isolate this is very artificial, and I doubt very much that this really prevents these sort of bias things. It has in my view entirely negative effect on the practice.
Yeah, the reviewing is another huge topic, right? Some people would say abolish reviewing anyway, just post publication reviews, and something
needs
to happen there.
There's a huge debate about reviewing and the publication crisis in science in general, right? I have no clear indication. I see what you mean with the problems with double blinds, but there are also problems with single blind. There are problems with no reviewing whatsoever. I cannot claim to have any kind of good argument for one over the other. I wouldn't know. No.
I'm always in favor of triple blind reviewing. You don't even see the paper, you know.
I would claim that's quadruple blind review. Triple blind is when the editor doesn't know, just for technical terms. Yeah, but I mean, the worry is that single blinded review becomes triple blinded review, right? I mean, nobody would ask me to review a paper of the most important mathematicians because, I mean, they would ask more capable people. But just in theory, how could I reject a paper by somebody so much better I'm trusting in? Whatever, so then this might be the worry.
Actually, I don't agree. I mean, I just joined a conference PC, and I said, and then they said, oh yeah, we want to make sure that every paper gets an expert reviewer. And I said, I agree. However, I think we also need to make sure that every paper get a non-expert reviewer, because while as a non-expert reviewer, you may not be able to criticize the results, but you may be very much and better able to criticize the presentation.
I'm not saying which journal said that to me, but one editor told me we mostly accept papers with one positive and one negative review, because this shows that there is something really
debate.
Sad there.
Exactly.
I
used this argument. By the way, I used this argument in PCs. We had some papers which were very controversial. And I said, yeah, we need to accept this and we have the discussion at the conference. At least this is something interesting, yeah?
Yeah.
Exactly this argument, yeah.
Yeah.
Case study too, still to be done to look more into the reviewing practice. With the
on mathematical reviewing, there's already a lot, right? I mean, there's... I mean, the whole work of Lina Anderson on mathematical reviewing practices, which was a kind of empirical study, right? So there, you know, Lina was talking to mathematicians, despite your reservations, Thorsten, right? And asking them about, okay, so how do you review, right? The outcomes of this are fascinating, right? I mean, so people report that they would like to adhere to the kind of epistemic ideal that you check every line of the proof and make sure that everything works out nicely. But this is not how reviewing ordinarily goes, right? So there are various kind of heuristics, so these kind of fallible strategies that you might use to check whether something is correct or not. So maybe it just looks like something that you already know and what you know is correct. So that will probably also be okay. Or you just check a couple of examples for general claims, or you know, there's deference to authority in there. So you, right, the argument Dennis made earlier, like you just accept the claim because it's some champion of the field who's making these claims, so they will probably know best, and many more strategies like this that feature in contemporary reviewing practices of mathematics.
By the way, here we need to mention formalization also. I mean, this is already very important in computer science, that the correctness issue is sort of solved in a way by saying, okay, I have a formal proof. And the question is still, is this interesting, or is the presentation good, and so on. The correctness is can be delegated to a formal proof.
Uh-huh.
And you mean to reopen this translation debate, the other half, which I hadn't mentioned, like Fenna, Raf, or whoever. I mean,
I love them.
Brandon. They would say, is this even the thing you are claiming you have proved? And so there's an Descartes would now say there the last step, there needs to be some soul in that step, so it cannot be completely formalized whether you really got the right thing. Contrast to Leibniz.
What is happening is that people give a sort of more human readable account and then also submit their formalization. And then the people hired, apart from reviewers, who look at the artifacts and in particular check whether the artifact actually reflects what's said in the paper or what sort of assumptions are made and so on. So yeah, obviously that's important.
Yeah, but in the moment that you don't have a full grasp of your set of theorems, there it might be problematic. I think the Mitsa project suffered from that in the 70s, in the later stages, that it simply wasn't clear if this is really new, if are there like these small nuanced changes. Okay, we are going quickly towards our informal limit. So let me maybe ask you to, is there anything you would really like to problematize in another 5 minutes? Then this is the moment.
Me to problematize something? Oh,
or Torsten, if you still have a pressing question, then let us thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Always. And then to the listeners, as always, subscribe, hype, comment, give a thumbs up or 5 stars, whatever, in order to force this upon the pages of more potentially interested people. And
Let us know what we should do better. I mean, that's always the other alternative.
Yeah, that's maybe we will even listen. No, we will. But after the first 10 episodes, which will be recorded at a batch and then released afterwards. Great. Then thank you again and see you around.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.